Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Narration by George podcast. This is episode 10 of the podcast on audiobooks, spiritual ideas, and other items of interest. Today, we have a special guest with us on the telephone. I'll introduce her in just a moment. In the last two podcasts, we've talked about the merger of audiobooks and spiritual ideas. Our first episode dealt with devotional books that I've had the privilege to produce. And last week, we looked at a historical novel and a young adult novel based on the Christmas story. And this week, I want to share with you a book by Becky Woolley called Nonprofit Murders. That prophet is spelled P-R-O-P-H-E-T, Nonprofit Murders. Now, full disclosure here, Becky and I have been friends for several years. We've gone to church together and ministered together. It's a real honor for me to have the opportunity to narrate and produce her novel. Becky is a minister's wife and the former church secretary. She and her husband have partnered in full-time ministry for some 42 years. She has writing credits in four states, and she and her husband have been affiliated with seven universities, five Christian schools, and 15 congregations. And as a church secretary, she says she knows where all the bodies are buried. I talked with Becky about this book and what she is trying to tell all of us. Start out, please, by telling us a little bit of your story.
Well, my husband and I have been in ministry for 42 years, and I have served in different capacities during that time, and also as a church secretary. So I was very much on the inside of institutional religion, and when I wrote my murder mysteries, my concepts and ideas that I had not been able to express came out in my book, which surprised me. But it was a catharsis. It was informative to me to find out what I really felt and how repressed I really was.
So how did you conceive of Nonprofit Murders?
Well, the very first thing I wrote that I thought was going to end up in a book was a description of the heroine's mother. It was an essay that I had written, and it was a picture of her in a nursery in a church. I have realized since that it is a picture that I thought people had of a typical minister's wife. I thought this is what the members of the church thought I should be. That scared me to death because I knew I was nowhere near this person. And it's also a picture of the type of legalism that I had always rebelled against.
Is this the Sunday school, Miss Dinah's Sunday school?
Yes.
Yeah. Actually, it's one of my favorite passages in the book.
Okay. I'll set it up. Miss Dinah is the wife of the preacher, and she's also the mother of the heroine of the story. The heroine's name is Grace, and she has been performing her minister wife's duties for the last 23 years, and here's a picture of one of the things that she's very good at.
Every Tuesday morning, Grace's mom, Ms. Dinah, to church members, taught a Bible class to infants and toddlers at the Bennettville One True Church. This Tuesday, as always, she sat a bit lopsided but triumphantly cross-legged on a small cushion in the floor of the church nursery. Her lush but graying locks poked from a hand towel fastened to her head with a tattered strip of cloth. She wore an orange-striped bathrobe. A dozen or so equally accurate biblical costumes hung in a closet at home. She had been lowering herself into the lotus position at least once a week in a church nursery somewhere in the Bible Belt for the last 23 years. For the last four, she had found it worthwhile to pray to her 50-year-old knees for forgiveness on the way down, and to ask the good Lord for comfort and salvation when she attempted to rise. Between prayers, she found redemption in the drooling faces of the squirming, gurgling infants, safety belted into jumper seats and arranged in a semicircle at the extreme limit of her bifocals. This Tuesday morning she squinted at four insouciant faces, happily crossing and uncrossing their own unfocused eyes toward plastic versions of baby Moses and his sister Miriam that she held just within reach of their flailing arms. Prophet and prophetess swam giddily in and out of focus.
"Moses," Miss Dinah intoned.
"Moses," her smile in spasms attempting to form itself around her wonderfully long O's.
"Moses was a baby just like you," she broke into song. "Just like you, just like you. Moses was a baby just like you so very long ago. Miriam was his sister, yes, indeed, yes, indeed, yes, indeed. Miriam was his sister, yes, indeed, so very long ago."
At heart, Miss Dinah was more actress than teacher, a holdover from her wicked days as a drama major. But she did not analyze. She picked up a small covered basket and held it toward the wayward limbs of her charges. "Pat the basket, Mackenzie, honey." Mackenzie's errant extremities made contact. For an instant, both eyes were on target.
"Good girl, Moses' basket."
Miss Dinah enticed another customer.
"Benjamin, pat the basket."
She guided a hopelessly disobedient hand to its owner's objective.
"Very good. Good, Benjamin. Very good."
Benjamin, finally able to grasp the elusive basket, could not let go. By pure instinct, he drew the inedible toy toward his all-purpose mouth.
"No, no, Benjamin. Just pat the basket, Benjamin."
Miss Dinah gave a gentle tug.
"Benjamin, let Hannah..."
"Tug."
"Let Hannah have the..."
"Tug."
"Basket."
Hannah began to yowl as the five-minute buzzer signaled the imminent return of doting mothers in the moment of truth from Miss Dinah's knees. She carefully unhinged her visual aid from Benjamin's involuntary but tenacious grip, then gave Hannah and Matthew access. Each in turn willed a recalcitrant hand toward the target and reacted in holy surprise upon contact. A baby miracle followed by a fully mature one. Miss Dinah stood up. Up being the position she achieved once all of her joints, especially her knees, had indeed forgiven her. She issued a vanilla wafer to each sweet communicant, cleaned four faces, eight hands, and matched diaper bag to child, just in time for the last bell. Another baby Bible class down, and another crop of angels beginning a study of the Mosaic dispensation. Last week, it had been the last of several lessons on the patriarchal dispensation. These four students, as hundreds before them, had petted the rubber snake, tapped Noah's wooden ark, groomed his animals, snatched at Esau's hairy arms, a woolly sheepskin, felt Jacob's rocky pillow, and stroked Joseph's embroidered coat. But the Mosaic dispensation was Miss Dinah's favorite. She had G-rated props to simulate each of the 10 plagues. It had taken several years to come up with a proper carbuncle. She had a red dishpan rigged to divide the waters, stone tablets inscribed in Hebrew, and every year she built the walls of Jericho out of Rice Krispie treats. She had even, after much trial and error, come up with tangible props for 6 of the 10 commandments. She had nothing suitable for idolatry or blasphemy. Adultery and murder were out of the question. In the end, she simplified the concepts into pat phrases that the babies might understand. In a year or two, "Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, and thou shalt not commit adultery" became, "Don't grab another child's toy." "Thou shalt not murder" came out, "Don't hit anybody." Over the years, Miss Dinah developed her own primitive theology. Every action was either right or wrong, good or evil. Every person was saved because of their good deeds or damned because of their sin. The patriarchs and prophets were exempt, she reasoned. After all, Abraham and Jacob lied, Moses committed murder, Aaron worshipped idols, and Isaiah ran around naked. Some Old Testament stories could only be taught to adults, and some would never be mentioned in Sunday school at any age. If you haven't picked up on it yet, this book is filled with satire, characters that are really caricatures. Satire, of course, takes situations to the extreme to point out what the author is trying to tell us. So back up and just kind of fill us in on a little of the plot for folks who don't know the book.
Grit and Grace, a hero and heroine. Grit is very disillusioned with Christianity. He's been going to a Christian school, and he himself feels very hemmed in. But rather than try to examine his faith and come to an understanding of Christianity, he moves away from it. Grace, on the other hand, examines her faith and comes out of legalism into a more free religion. But the two of them get together. Grit comes around, renews his faith, and in the process, they are exposed to four murders. Three murders and then a terrible accident that almost killed Grit. They are involved in trying to solve the murders of three preachers and this accident that happened to Grit.
Okay.
And they're assuming that somewhere out there is a maniacal murderer who's out to get all the preachers in town.
Right. So tell us about these preachers.
Oh, dear. As I wrote the book, I found myself relishing the deaths of these men. And I tried to make them as ludicrous as possible, the men and the murders. Because to me, the extreme positions that these men have taken religiously are worthy of at least violent death. Grace's own father is a preacher, and he is stuck in a very legalistic church that has pressed itself into a corner where they believe that they have to get everything right. If they don't get everything right, then they're all going to end up doomed to hell. So everybody is picking at everybody else, trying to figure out, oh, did you do this right? Are you doing this right? It's not a pretty picture. And his sermon, from which he is released by electrocution, he is preaching on a service that the Presbyterians had performed, and they had done drama. They had done drama in the church. So his conclusion is that all the Presbyterians are going to hell because they're not following the pattern of worship that is required. The second preacher is a very powerful man who has managed to build a huge church in a thriving university, which is slipping from his control, and he sees it falling away. But in his sermon, he is a very Zionistic, very militaristic preacher, who is preaching a sermon about how we've got to support Israel and we've got to do it, that their military is better than everybody else's. And in the middle of his sermon, he falls down with an apparent heart attack. And then we have the Reverend Bishop. His mother actually named her son Reverend, so he is Reverend. And then he became a preacher and then became a bishop. So he is now Reverend Bishop. He is a very political man. His actual ambitions have nothing to do with religion. They have everything to do with politics and power. So he comes down with food poisoning at a political rally, and it takes him 3 or 4 days to die. But they all die on the same day, and that same Sunday, Grit is up preaching a sermon on being obedient and honoring your parents. And he is, all of his sound equipment falls down and nearly kills him. So he ends up in the hospital. Those are my four preachers.
Let's listen to one of the preacher death scenes. My favorite for portraying in the book was the death of the Reverend Lawson. Take a listen. Pastor Lawson launched into a particularly energized exhortation for Christians to rise up in support of God, country, and Israel. Looking down, Grit saw the pastor's carefully sprayed white comb-over swaying hypnotically with the ebb and flow of the sermon. As the practiced orator warmed to his message, his voice became a deep brass instrument, resounding from the walls and sending Grit back to his gauges. At a particularly dramatic moment, the charismatic, visibly aging leader paused. He took a long drink from his glass, then slapped his open Bible. "Thou shalt not commit adultery." Another pause. "The rapture is only the beginning, children." Troy, Amber, and Ricky stood to exit, moving into the camera frame. Tom switched cameras to Mackie's close-up of Lawson and signaled Cale to change angles. No one outside of Holy City would see the insubordination. Pastor Lawson did not miss a beat. His basso profundo rang out con brio in march time. "It won't be very long till this short life shall end. It won't be very long till Jesus shall descend, and then the bride of Christ will meet him on that shore. Andante, you won't want to be in this world any more." A whole rest. Four long beats during which the protesters exited. Lawson glanced their way and slapped his Bible again, disguising the sound of the large wooden door swinging shut. "Woe to the drunkards, the harlots, and the whoremongers! Woe to the fornicators, the adulterers, and the hypocrites!" He switched instruments, his words low and powerful, shaking his listeners like the growl of an idling full-bore engine, his tone and pace a rumbling, irresistible sotto voce. He spoke directly into the microphone, confiding to his audience earnestly, "Only God knows what is in store for the sinners left behind." Pause. "Left behind to suffer." Pianoforte. "Left behind, caught on the wrong side of the battle between the god of guns, guts, and glory, and the ancient enemy, Satan." Another dramatic pause, another long drink, this one emptying the glass. Lawson hit the accelerator and began climbing through the gears. "There will be weeping," first gear, "and gnashing of teeth," second. "The heavens will open and," he double-clutched into fourth, "the mountains will tumble, Gibraltar may crumble." Now in overdrive, "they're only made of clay," roaring down the straightaway, "the fires of hell." Pastor Lawson wiped his brow, faltered, and began again. "The fires of hell." An incongruous smile lit his red, sweating face, his motor overheated. He clutched his chest, looked straight up at Grit, and giggled. "Oh, the rapture! Oh, the rapture!" Newell Post Lawson laughed in ecstasy as he hit the floor dead.
So what spiritual ideas were you wanting to communicate in this book? What are you trying to get across to your audience?
I honestly, when I started writing, had no notion of putting spiritual ideas in the book. Apparently, what I am comes out of what I write, and I'm definitely a spiritual person. And I found out after the book was written that I had written in the genre that's called clerical crime.
Clerical crime. Okay.
Clerical crime is any sort of a mystery novel which the solution is found by someone who's involved in a wizard's body. There are Catholic clerical crimes. There are Jewish clerical crimes. There are Episcopal clerical crimes. Mm-hmm. There's all different religions that are represented in this genre. And I had read the genre extensively, not knowing that's what I was doing. But the main point of any clerical crime is that the author is talking about religion. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about what's right about it, what's wrong about it, and I find the subject fascinating, and apparently that's why I wrote about it.
Okay.
You can have whole sections where the characters are talking about what they believe, and that naturally produces information about their spirituality.
Right.
I particularly wanted to get across, once I found out that's what I was writing about, what I really wanted to get across was the idea that Christianity is not a set of rules. Christianity is faith in Christ, mm-hmm. and following Christ. And it's freeing. It's not hemming in. It is absolutely freeing.
Right. Any other messages you want the reader to take away from your book?
I want them to enjoy the book. I want them to think about what they believe. That is very important to me.
Mm-hmm.
I've had people that are close to me who have come out of a very legalistic religion, and they love my books because they can laugh all the way through what they've experienced,
mm-hmm.
what they have come out of, and they can see, yes, this is ludicrous. Yes, this is something that needs to be pointed out, even among Christians.
Mm-hmm.
We as Christians need to be able to say, look, the world is pointing fingers at us and laughing. Let's figure out whether or not they're laughing legitimately. You know, there may be some things that we are doing or thinking or believing that are absolutely ludicrous. And yes, we need to self-examine, and yes, we need to laugh at ourselves.
So now let's listen to a sample of some of the message which Becky wants us all to hear. And in this scene, Grit is found in a coffee shop with an old buddy named Troy who's been away for a while, and they use this time to catch up.
Troy Michelson returned to campus late that summer with his master's degree and a bride, Amber. Pastor Lawson had hired both to teach communication classes beginning in the fall. A week after his and Amber's arrival in Bennettville, Troy caught sight of Grit standing in a coffee shop. He and Amber hurried in. Troy slapped Grit on the back and made introductions. "Amber, this is Grit. I mean, Truman Griffin." Grit managed a smile and an automatic, "Grit's okay. Hi." He extended his hand while admiring Amber's green eyes and sassy auburn bob. "No wonder I haven't heard from Troy for a while," he said. "Looks like he had better things to do than call me." "Yeah, man, sorry about that," Troy apologized. "I didn't mean to blow you off. We sent you an invitation." Awkward silence. Grit fumbled for something to say. "I was homeless and drunk. It's just that I, do you have a minute?" Amber asked. Grit wasn't sure if he did. He was not ready to debate religion, and he certainly did not want to alienate a friend. Troy pointed to an empty table. "Here, have a seat. I'll get us some coffee. What would you like?" Grit took his black. Amber ordered a latte. Left alone with Amber, Grit couldn't find words to start a conversation. She smiled and asked about school. He was explaining why he had left New Jerusalem in January, just as Troy returned with the coffee. "I've given up on legalism, too," Troy said. "I'm determined to know nothing but Jesus Christ and Him crucified." He quoted the Apostle Paul. "How did that happen?" Grit asked. "It's mostly Amber's doing," Amber chuckled. "But I wasn't even a Christian when we met. And when I found out he was a fundamentalist, I just thought, like, that's going to happen." "Amber's parents are professors at a state university," Troy added. "They teach that human beings are just a higher life form, and they think all religions are just myths made up to explain anything people don't understand. When I left home, I jumped in and out of religions as often as I changed college majors," Amber said. "Nothing held my interest. I was just a stew of questions like, where did I come from? What am I here for? I went down some pretty lonely, dangerous roads." Grit opened his mouth to empathize. Amber put down her empty cup. "Do either of you want a refill?" Both men said, "Sure," and Amber took their cups to the counter. Grit watched her effortless stride. She was tall and confident, more confident than any female of Grit's acquaintance. Everything about her suggested she was not the type who would find Troy irresistible. Troy read Grit's thoughts and laughed. She was definitely not overwhelmed by my charm. Grit took a deep breath and said what he was really thinking. I have a lot of questions about my faith, he confessed, if I have any. Amber returned with three steaming cups and three long oval pastries on a small tray. Grit picked up a pastry and inspected.
Biscotti, Amber said. It's Italian.
Grit took a bite. Sort of a cross between a cookie and toast, he said. I like it. Troy took a piece.
I know where you're coming from, Grit, he said.
He gestured toward his wife. This woman challenged me with her questions more than I satisfied her with my answers. Amber handed Grit his coffee and took her seat.
I didn't need new answers, she said. Troy needed new questions. Questions neither of us had ever asked, like, how do we know God exists? How can we know that he cares?
I'd never even thought about such, Troy agreed. Stuff like, what does God have to do with morality? What difference does it make? Why should any religion be better than another?
But the one that really stumped us both was, why is there such a disparity between the teachings of Christ and the practices of institutional Christianity?
Once we got the questions right, the answers came. They weren't simple or easy, but they were clear and true, Troy said.
Amber smiled and took Troy's hand. We both confessed Christ as Lord, and I was baptized.
Troy kissed his bride. 4 months later, we were married.
Grit changed the subject.
How did you ever get hired to teach at New Jerusalem with all your heretical beliefs? And why would you want to?
Amber laughed.
I think we slipped in under the radar.
Troy agreed.
We're stealth communications teachers. I've never told Pastor Lawson or anyone at the school about my new understanding of things, and before I left, I talked to him about coming back to teach. At the time, he was my hero. He's an amazing speaker.
You're right about that, Grit grimaced. Amber continued, We stayed in the Zionist Christian fold all along. We didn't really know where else to go.
Believe me, we looked, Troy added. We just don't fit into any mold.
But why come back? Grit asked.
I didn't want to. I knew we would be walking into trouble, and I didn't want to drag Amber into a religious war.
God has something for us to do here, Amber added, regardless of our own welfare.
I believe New Jerusalem is going to have to understand and adapt to our postmodern culture or die. Troy launched into a sermon. Christians have to stop fighting each other and start fighting Satan. We need to stop hating sinners and start saving them.
How can any non-religious person see past American Christianity to Christ?
Christians need to be one as Christ and the Father are one, one in love, one in purpose, one in spirit.
Grit listened through two more rounds of biscotti. Troy and Amber's answers rang true. The most resonant, the gospel is spread by living and dying for Christ, not as Lawson had taught, by killing for the kingdom. He was ready to enlist.
So where do I sign? He said.
The book is called Nonprofit Murders. You can find it at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. I've produced the audiobook version, and it's available by checking at my website, narrationbygeorge.com, and search for Nonprofit Murders. Or you can go to narrationbygeorge.com/non-profit-murders. Becky is also the author of another Grit and Grace mystery called Murder Intelligently Designed. She uses that book to take a look at apologetics. If you want to laugh, scratch your head over whodunit, and accept a spiritual challenge, pick up one of her books. You can find out more about Becky by visiting her webpage. That's Grit and Grace Mysteries, all one word, .weebly.com. Or search her name, Becky Woolley, that's spelled W-O-O-L-E-Y, in Google. You'll find her blog at this same web address as well. So that's our time for today. Thanks for joining me for the Narration by George podcast, the podcast on audiobooks, spiritual ideas, and other items of interest. Don't forget, this podcast is new every Wednesday. You can subscribe to us in the iTunes Store or in your favorite podcast player. If you need directions, just go to my website, narrationbygeorge.com. Click on the link for podcast instructions. See you next Wednesday when we're going to talk about some history.